Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Wellfleet Global, and our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem in Asia and globally by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. It's my pleasure to have with us today Dr. Parag Khanna. Parag is a leading global strategy advisor, a world traveler, and a best-selling author. He's the founder and managing partner of FutureMap, a data and scenario-based strategic advisory firm. And his newest book is The Future is Asian, Commerce, Conflict, and Culture in the 21st Century. Parag has been an advisor to the U.S. National Intelligence Council's Global Trends 2030 program. He was also a senior researcher fellow in the Center of Asia and Globalization at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan as a senior geopolitical advisor to United States Special Operations Forces, as well as he worked at the World Economic Forum in Geneva and served as a research associate at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He holds a PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics, as well as a bachelor's and master's degree from the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Parag, thanks for your time, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
So let's start a little bit with your book, and then I know that you were saying somewhere that you were going to call the book "The Present is Asian," not "The Future is Asian," as you ultimately called it. But you found that title to not be very catchy, and the reason why you were thinking of calling it "The Present is Asian" because that's also the reality, and by every metric that matters, we already live in the Asian century. So tell us maybe. What's the story behind the book, and what are some of the most powerful reasons that made you write the book?
It's a great question, and of course, it does begin with a sort of humorous note in the sense that one could have called the book that, and it would have been obviously a parody on book titles. but indeed, the fundamental facts behind what you're saying and my motivation, you know, really are, you know, the sort of driving impetus because, you know, we do live in a world where more than 50% of the world population is in Asia, where 50% of the global GDP in purchasing power terms is in Asia. And, you know, a lot of other driving forces in terms of growth of trade and infrastructure investment, you know, cross-border flows of people, so many things that really matter in the world today, the growing valuations of companies, the number of, you know, mega cities, all of these things are really, really centered upon Asia. And that is the present. It's not a forecast. So it would take an extremely, extremely strong and quite frankly, non-existent argument to say that, well, this is just a blip or this is going to reverse and so on. So one of my motivations was therefore to help our mentality catch up with reality, because the reality is that we live in an Asian world. It's just that certain mindsets, many mindsets, haven't adjusted. And the second, and I'm sure we'll come back to it, is that to the extent that there is a big focus on Asia, which there rightly has been, it has been overwhelmingly about China. And I wanted to, again, bring us into the present and the future, where China, rather than dominating Asia more and more, actually is, you find faster growth rates now in Southeast Asia. You find that the Indian population will soon surpass that of China, and India's growth is already faster than China's. So Asia is multipolar. Asia has been multipolar for millennia, and Asia will be multipolar again. So to remove the conflation of Asia with all of China, or China with all of Asia, was really another motivation as well.
Excellent point. And right now, also to kind of bring to the next question, which is excellent point. I mean, with the importance of all the other countries in Asia that are growing more and more in terms of both economic power and development, Southeast Asia, India, and now with the trade war between the U.S. and China, that also makes a very significant case and impact, and has already had a significant impact in terms of raising the level of some of the other ASEAN countries in terms of manufacturing and output and trade. Tell us a little bit about this, and tell us your thoughts on the trade war. What are some of the effects that you're seeing? What are maybe some of the effects that you were not expecting? What's your views on it?
Well, I think that people have mistakenly taken the U.S.-China trade war as if it is the sum total of all trade, but it isn't. You know, I mean, the fact is that already today, and certainly even well before the trade war broke out, European trade with China is substantially larger than American trade with China. And one of the key consequences of the trade war will be that China will trade even more with Europe and less with the United States. So, in fact, the U.S.-China economic relationship becomes less central to the global economic system. Of course, there are regulatory consequences in terms of how protectionism, technological nationalism, you know, the so-called splinter net and things like this that emerge from tensions between Europe and China, between the U.S. and China. But I think we have to be very careful in pretending that somehow, you know, what the U.S. does or what China does dictates all of global trade. That's simply not true. And what we can see already is that not only does Europe trade more with China than the U.S. does, but it's obviously pushing very hard to have Airbus gain a much greater share of the Chinese market than Boeing. That's already the case now. We're going to see, of course, imports of China, of European technology goods, you know, substitute for those from the United States. We're going to see, you know, we're already seeing Europe push very hard to have greater access to Asian markets, whereas the United States has pulled out the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement as well, which has nothing to do with China because China didn't join it either. Meanwhile, Europe is a push for an FTA with Japan, with ASEAN, and with India. So we're going to see Eurasia become much more important. We're already seeing supply chains that have moved out of China into Southeast Asia. And it's very important, you know, for everyone to remember the sequencing. The trade war is not the reason why supply chains are shifting out of China. The trade war has accelerated supply chain shifting out of China. But it's been 10 years that many companies began to shift because of rising Chinese wages, because of competition from Chinese indigenous brands and companies, and now also because of the trade war. And also, of course, simply desire to be closer to a fast-growing market like Southeast Asia. So all of these things need to be taken into account in the proper sequence.
And I want also to ask you, because in your book you discuss the terms of new Asian values, and you namely specifically mention technocratic governance, mixed capitalism, and social conservatism. So maybe tell us a little bit about this and how all these values are making it maybe better for the region to grow and evolve.
Yes, I think that, you know, it's very interesting. The Asian values conversation of the early, mid-1990s was largely premised on a kind of, you know, a Chinese-centric sort of view around hierarchy and so forth. And that, you know, clearly was dismissed as crony capitalism after the financial crisis. So it has been really 20 years since people even used this phrase Asian value. So I wanted to be clear about what I call the new Asian values and craft it in a more secular way and also in a less China-centric way, and to really look at the broader Asian population and think about what are the kind of pragmatic guiding orientations that we can see already in common across Asian countries, whether they are China or non-Chinese, whether they are democratic or authoritarian. And I did find really that there is a certain sense of acceptance, again, with caveats. So, you know, Asia is a very diverse region, of course. But I did find, strangely, that despite all of the diversity of Asia, I found that, you know, there is a certain deference or acceptance of a kind of more technocratic approach to governance, in the sense that executive branches, executive leaders are given a fairly long leash, a long shelf life, if you will, in order to you know, in order to fulfill their mission or vision of long-term modernization. And I think that that is something that clearly we're not seeing in Western politics as much. So, you know, a deference to a strong executive is one, but a strong executive, by the way, is not a synonym for technocratic. I just want to be clear. You know, what I mean by technocratic is very much even more really about professionalism in governance. you know, strengthening of the capacity of civil services, usage of data in making policy. We're seeing now even poorer Asian countries do this, and that's again something that with Trump and Brexit and so forth, we see being somewhat abandoned in the West, and I think that's very detrimental. The other is mixed capitalism. This is much more obvious because obviously state government collaboration, collusion, coordination is much more prominent in Asia. It's obviously a huge part of the rise of the Japanese and Korean economies, and obviously in China as well. So state capitalism or mixed capitalism is very comfortable, you know, sort of in Asian systems, whereas, of course, it's a bit anathema in orthodox Western, you know, economic theory. And the third is this idea of really incremental social progressivism, you know, I call it social conservatism, where you can see that Asian countries, you know, are cautious about, the rights to free speech, you know, media freedom. They're very cautious about people being able to say anything they want, given the social diversity and ethnic diversity and religious diversity. So you can see now, if you look at media, if you look at internet censorship or, internet kind of speech laws and regulation, you see that, countries are being very careful about how to monitor fake news and so forth. And so that also stems from this cautious approach. Now, I'm not advocating any or all of these three, right? I'm saying that this is how it is. There are some ways in which it's good. There are other ways in which it's not good, of course. You know, clearly social conservatism and being, restrictive around free speech may on the one hand prevent racial hatred and violence from erupting. On the other hand, it can simply be a tool of, unnecessary censorship. So I'm very, very aware of all of these. And in the book, I'm very clear about which aspects of it I support and which ones I oppose.
And in terms specifically about technocratic governance, I wanted to ask you, and I think a lot of people listening to the podcast, maybe also from specifically maybe our listeners in Europe and in US, but also some in Asia, where could you give us some examples? Because I think it could actually add a lot of value in terms of making it a bit more specific. What you've seen, you mentioned obviously some more developed countries in Asia, some less developed, and still they kind of take this approach. Maybe do you, if it's okay to share some examples.
Yes, of course. And I think, it breaks down, also by wealth, and the kind of degree of maturity of a country. One can go back and look, obviously, at the Chinese Confucianist governance principles several thousand years ago and see some of the similarities, obviously, in terms of rigorous testing, of bureaucrats and so forth. But more commonly today and more relevant is, of course, the Singapore example, because this is a country that has taken the parliamentary democratic model of the United Kingdom, but grafted upon it a much stronger executive structure and party structure, but also, has maintained the strength and professionalism and really improved them of the civil service. And, the World Bank and other organizations do, measure and analyze these things. And it's fairly objectively now the case that Singapore's civil service is one of the, top ranked in the whole world. And you can look at, again, the usage of data, the academic training and qualifications of members of the civil service, and the extent to which cross-country comparisons and case studies are used in framing policies. All of these things are done with a high degree of rigor in Singapore. So from my perspective, as someone who moved here recently and, has been a lecturer at the Lee Kuan Yew School and participating in the executive education programs that we run, you see a very large number of civil servants and ministers, mayors, officials coming from all across Asia on a weekly basis in very large numbers, to learn about how to run a country, And so it is obviously perhaps paradoxical that one of the smallest countries in the world is teaching all these large countries how to govern themselves better. But when you think about it in functional terms, which is to say, how do we build a strong civil service? How do we learn how to collect the trash? How do we structure our ministries? How do we legislate and plan for and establish special economic zones? These are things that Singapore has already done very well. And so whether or not it's a big or a small country, there's a lot to be learned from what this country has already done.
And moving a little bit the discussion to the realm of supply chain and manufacturing and so on. And obviously Asia is, or Southeast Asia, there's a lot of islands in Southeast Asia. Asia in general, again, it's a big place with different countries, different cultures, high fragmentation sometimes. How do you see it in terms of supply chains and collaborations around supply chains and evolution of these supply chains in the region?
Yes, I think this is really critical because, we've not only seen governments take the organic and passive approach where simply by virtue of their low wages, they try to attract, low wage, a product assembly or intermediate assembly of goods. That would be a very kind of 1970s, 1980s approach to it. Instead, what we're seeing is that governments are getting smart and forecasting and trying to find a high value niche in global supply chains. You take Thailand, for example, that's branding itself as a hub for industry 4.0 in Southeast Asia. Now, obviously, indigenously, that's not something Thailand is up to. However, you see that by working with German investors, Japanese companies, and so forth, they're really trying to develop higher quality products, in automobile parts, for example, electronics, and so forth. So there really is a strategic element to supply chain competition. I also look at it in terms of, these bilateral pairings where wealthy and developed and modern, sophisticated Asian economies like Japan and South Korea have been strategically picking Southeast Asian countries and including also South Asia like India and making very large investments to upgrade and modernize those countries' capability to produce, high quality, large volume goods and components at a competitive cost. So there's a strategic development or aspect to it. There's an industrial policy element. There's a forecasting element. And this is what smart governments do, is look for those opportunities to capture not just the bottom of the supply chain, but really, the middle level.
Historically, also in terms of Asia, it's known for being the hub and the manufacturing hub. Now it used to be China. Now it's shifting more and more towards Southeast Asia. Obviously you mentioned India. Bangladesh is another hub for manufacturing that is growing more and more. I wanted to bring the discussion around the question of certain examples that you may know of governments and companies coming together and creating a better infrastructure, a better ecosystem in terms of this kind of adding value to the overall supply chain in the region and to the overall manufacturing side of the region.
Well, I think, inputs are coming, very much at the firm level as they, historically do. We're seeing a lot of companies, and this is important to think about in the context of the trade war, where we put too much attention really on, the sort of trade tensions. But from an investment standpoint, we actually see foreign investment volumes continuing to rise. That means firms are realizing that precisely because of trade protectionism, one has to be behind the border. One has to be inside the economies where one wants to sell or the regions where one wants to sell. So we'll actually see FDI into ASEAN rise as a result of the trade friction. And that means American companies and other Asian companies outsourcing more within Asia.
Mm-hmm. And specifically in terms of the C-level executives and in terms of the strategy that boards and CEOs should keep in mind for Asia in general, for maybe Southeast Asia in particular, you can split it whichever way you would want. What would be some of the most important points that they should have for in relation to some of the supply chain challenges that are existing right now and potential ways in which they can mitigate it or solve it for the future?
It's a great question. As much as we would like to think of ASEAN as a coherent region, there's still very large regulatory barriers, right? It's a great source of frustration. In fact, as much as ASEAN really is waking up, I genuinely believe, and trying to integrate further, the degree of inequality within ASEAN is as high as any region in the world, perhaps the highest, because if you think about it from a per capita or median income standpoint, you have countries like Singapore and Brunei, but then you also have East Timor and Myanmar. So you can't expect these countries to also have the same, degree of regulatory, standards you know, taking Singapore as the kind of gold standard versus the rest. So there are still a lot of soft barriers in the country in terms of capital flows, you know, access to purchasing domestic stakes in companies and so forth. So what executives have to bear in mind is they have to be part, not just do business here, but really help the weaker governments improve their standards and their governments and their governance. It's not going to happen on its own. So I see a very strong advocacy role. You know, I call it co-governance sometimes, you know, for foreign investors and corporate executives to think about. They have to be part of really coaching to improve the system. And that in a way accelerates the public-private sort of hybridization of governance in the region. So that's one thing I think that's very important. It really isn't just one homogenous region. In fact, it's perhaps the most diverse, again, most diverse sub-region in the entire world, if you think about the ethno-linguistic differences and the number of countries and so forth. And yet, though, with a you know, population of 700 million people, very young, median age, you know, this region really is in a sweet spot where all of the you know, the momentum and sort of trajectory is pointing in the right direction.
You mentioned Industry 4.0, and I think we were talking. You didn't specifically say Industry 4.0. We were talking about you know, industrial development and also what China has gone through in the last couple of years, where it's much more advanced from that perspective. And you have also different advancements like labor automation, especially in the West. Of course, you have. You know, you have IoT, you have different types of technologies that will automate a lot of the jobs on the manufacturing sector. How do you see this in the context of Asia? Because Asia has been historically a lower cost of labor type of a market. Are you seeing also that this type of labor automation is happening in Asia? Do you have some case studies, some examples? What's your perspective on this?
Oh, yeah, there's no question that, you know, labor automation. And because of labor automation in the industrialization that is taking place, the supply chains come into Asia more, are not going to create as many jobs as they did in previous decades. You know, productivity is also a driver, you know, part and parcel of that. So it's still creating lots of jobs. I mean, of course, to the extent that there is marginal growth in manufacturing labor around the world, it's in Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia. However, what's important to remember is that Southeast Asian economies are not the same as, again, the 1970s or 80s. They've already become services economies. So they're getting the manufacturing work, but they don't need it as much as a generation ago. So these are services economies where urbanization, digitization, financialization, and so forth are already huge drivers of the economy. So when it comes to supply chains, you know, it isn't, again, just about how can I get the jobs, right? It's how can they get high-value jobs, because otherwise you won't see the wages be high enough for these countries to overcome the so-called middle-income trap. So there is a lot of debate about this phenomenon of automation and premature deindustrialization, right? You know, will these countries be hollowed out because of robotics and automation affecting the labor force prior to the income and savings rising above that lower, you know, middle-income trap? And I think because of the services transition, these economies will largely, you know, overcome that and get beyond it. Again, it's a very diverse set of countries, so I'm not talking about, you know, the poorest ones right now. But I think that each society is coping with that in its own way.
I mean, it's an excellent point, and it's going to be interesting to see, because for sure, whereas maybe 10, 15, 5 even years ago, manufacturing companies would come to Asia because it would be cheap, let's say. Now we're seeing more and more the reverse trend of taking back into the, or I think it's called insourcing, manufacturing in countries like Germany to be close to the consumer, and the factories are highly automated, so it's almost no humans inside, and obviously all that production is no longer going to be somewhere in it can be Asia, it can also be South America, I guess, but and it's going to be back in Germany. So indeed, that's an interesting dynamic. I'm totally not an expert in this and how it's going to pan out in the future, but it is happening. that kind of brings me to the next question also in terms of there's other things that Asia is taking a lead on in terms of the world. There's, for example, in China, obviously, they've done a fantastic job at payments, at the payment system. And basically, there's almost cashless cities in China. And they've managed to do a lot of innovations and applications that even you can't find in the West. So I wanted to ask you, not specifically only about payments, but I wanted to ask you in terms of some of the most interesting innovation projects and applications that you've seen coming out of Asia and then maybe impacting the global economy and basically forcing other parts of the world to implement similar applications.
So this is one of the areas where we can clearly see that Asian innovation, particularly coming out of China, you know, have given the immediate scale of expansion in the Chinese market and then international acquisition and expansion of those firms really become a world-leading phenomenon. You know, the instantaneous mobile payments and the access to financial products through apps, you know, is really more evolved in China than anywhere. And really, it's an example of leapfrogging, if you will. And now we see other countries and their app ecosystems, you know, copying that model as they quickly, you know, allow banks and telecoms to collaborate more freely to come up with these kinds of products. So, you know, we're seeing with even poorer countries in Indonesia, like Indonesia, you have Gojek. It's also trying to be a super app. So super app is the term that really, you know, captures this phenomenon of a one-stop portal that allows you to do everything from a mobile, you know, from mobile phone calling and communications and chat functions to financial products, transportation, and so forth. And I think that is, you know, really it's very, very hard already to capture the productivity gains from the falling cost of technology. But now looking at the rising productivity in terms of efficiency of transactions that result from this kind of super app, a super appification is also something that's very difficult to quantify. You know, we do know it makes our lives incredibly convenient, you know, just how much economic value that has, but it is, of course, tremendous.
E-commerce is another big trend, and it's also growing tremendously in Asia, probably faster than anywhere else in the world. Specifically, also in Southeast Asia, it's playing a part because it's kind of also fostering these collaborations between the ASEAN nations in terms of also cross border as well as doing more trade together. How do you see e-commerce as a general catalyst, maybe to closer collaboration between countries and also its impact on a bigger picture as well?
Yes, I mean, you know, I think e-commerce is one of those crucial test beds, if you will, for regional integration, because you do still have those borders, right? Customs clearance, as everyone in the supply chain world knows, is a significant drag and cost factor that you know, eliminates some of the gains from what would otherwise be wage and, you know, geographic efficiencies. So the rise of cross-border e-commerce through either, you know, the e-commerce green lanes in logistics that have arisen between Asian countries have facilitated that, but also, of course, the cross-border acquisitions. You know, for example, Alibaba's very large stake in SingPost and other moves around the region that relate to the e-commerce marketplaces, logistics combined with retail, and the payments ecosystem. You know, bringing these verticals together into cross-border conglomerates has really helped to facilitate the movement of goods around the region. So I think that you know, e-commerce is a very important and thus far very positive litmus test, if you will, of how the digital dimension of supply chain can bring about the regional integration that we've really been talking about for a long time, but not necessarily doing.
And moving the discussion towards also the human element and towards skills and towards what you see in terms of skills necessary for the markets and skill shortages maybe in particular. And again, we're talking about a highly diverse type of geographical scope, right? Because it's not the same what might be a shortage in China versus somewhere in ASEAN versus in India. But what do you see as certain trends in terms of what skills are necessary and needed in Asia, and maybe there's shortages of, specifically again for the supply chain and manufacturing side?
Right. I think it's actually a very, very good question. And again, it depends on the country, right? I mean, you know, China is already past the point in terms of its labor force size. It's actually declining at this point. So they want to automate, and they have been automating very quickly, which is helps to account for exports and output, maintaining their steady performance despite the shrinking of the labor force. So, you know, other countries have not automated really at all. You know, there's a real need to bring in the kinds of technologies that help to refine or improve, augment, you know, human capability. If countries like Vietnam want to produce more high value added goods, they're going to need more precision kinds of industrial machinery and so forth from Europe, or to import it from Korea, Japan, and so on. So, you know, depending on the degree of complexity in a country's economy, there's substantial need still with many Asian countries to bring in that kind of technology and know-how. And again, that's what every country I see, you know, in Asia is starting to do, or is already well advanced in doing. And this is a sign, again, that they think of supply chains as something very strategic, you know, active rather than passive. And that to me is very, very promising.
Regarding the executive level and regarding the CEOs, regarding the board members of companies, what would you say are the key attributes that they should have in order to stay relevant in Asia, right? So it may be people, it may be of Asian heritage, it may be, you know, expats that are coming here to lead different operations. What would you say that is very important for them to understand and pay attention to in the next years to basically keep their companies relevant?
That's a very good question. So, you know, and part of it we were discussing earlier in terms of what should leaders know about Asia, right? And the first thing is you need to have a regional and a country presence. You know, there has to be an ASEAN strategy, but also obviously a country level strategy for countries as big as Indonesia and Vietnam, and starting to appreciate the connectivity between those markets. You know, you see trade, again, obviously intermediate and finished goods trade between the countries, you know, whether it's Thailand and Myanmar, or Vietnam and Thailand, and then Indonesia with Malaysia and others. All of those sort of dyads are growing. So you have to really have a strong on-the-ground presence and strong local knowledge to capitalize on that. Because otherwise, of course, especially if you're a foreign firm, you know, you're really going to be missing out because really the local markets are ambitious enough, you know, leaders are ambitious enough to go and push for these kinds of this kind of integration.
And I don't know if you've touched upon it in the book as well on this aspects of leadership and different types of dealing with different cultures, because Asia again is super diverse and there's different ways that may work, for example, with the employees in Vietnam, but may not work in Thailand, or, you know, the other way around. Do you see also in terms of how to get the best out of people? And it might be more of a personal opinion than I'm asking from you right now, but do you see, and do you have some sharings, right, in terms of what you've observed that works best, depending on the country, depending maybe on, you know, let's split it in ASEAN, India, or China, that works the best in terms of getting the best out of people, out of organizations, out of cultures?
Well, you know, obviously there's no substitute these days, right, for digital literacy, right? So you really want to have the educational systems, the vocational systems, the business sponsorship of academic training programs really be as state of the art as possible. And so we're finding that, you know, I find that obviously one of the key metrics of, you know, national success in improving productivity is going to come from having a lot stronger government, you know, support for industry, you know, sponsoring and playing a role in shaping educational curricula, again, at the technical and vocational level. And so that's something that, you know, Europe has a very long history of, particularly, of course, Germany, Switzerland, and other countries. Singapore has started to, you know, copy that model as well. You know, in Korea, it's quite strong. So this is going to be critical, is, you know, sort of that alignment between business, government, and industry, business, government, and academia, and you know, having it be as sort of, you know, e-ready as possible.
That's an excellent point, and I think it's called tripartite alignment, and I've also been involved in one or two discussions, and definitely I would agree that Singapore is doing a great job in terms of facilitating such discussions. But there's other good case studies in other countries within Asia where it's happening, and it's critical to adapt and adopt quite fast because technology is moving very fast. So all of a sudden, what you learn in school in 5 years might not be relevant anymore. So basically, education has to be aligned with what companies want, and the government has to respond to somehow mitigating all of this. So it's not an easy task. It's a daunting task, but it kind of boils down to your point of digital literacy and making sure that people are keep themselves updated to what is happening and what is relevant. To conclude our discussion, I also wanted to ask you a question regarding a more of a personal standpoint regarding some of the younger listeners on the podcast, but also not necessarily the younger, but it's people that would want to learn from you. You've had a successful career. You've been exposed to a lot of different international organizations. What would be some pieces of advice that you have received, or that you have, or principles that you have followed that helped you be successful in your career so far?
Well, that's a very good question. For me, mobility, has probably been the most significant thing as a generic term, just to represent, travel and seeking out different opportunities in different locations. So whether all of the different places I've studied or the places that I've traveled for my on the ground research, and also now having lived in four or five different countries over the last decade, all of that has played a significant role for me in terms of feeling like I can confidently have my finger on the pulse of global trends and write about them in a way that's also forward looking. So I definitely attribute a lot of what has contributed to my present career positioning to traveling.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I mean, I could not agree more. Actually, it definitely forces you out of your comfort zone as well, and it makes you look at things in a different light. So fully supportive. Obviously, I'm also here in Singapore, but not from here, and it makes a lot of difference to be exposed to different cultures. So thanks for sharing that, Parag, and thanks for sharing also all the good examples and case studies, as well as trends that you're seeing, and the reason why Asia is the place to be in the present as well as in the future. And appreciate it.
Exactly right.
Super. Be in touch, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.